Hello, and welcome to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks, a series of talks by scholars and graduate students on all aspects of film, television, and screen-based media. If you'd like to join our network or find out more about us, you can follow us on Twitter at @SSSNetwork and like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies. You can also visit our website at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.
Hello. So basically, to give even more background, the basis for this is that now UNSW School of Arts and Media, parts of the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences, runs a cool thing called the SAM Bursaries. And the way that works is they give you, if you're someone going into honours, you apply and you are awarded $5,000 to write a 5,000-word piece on a topic that's set for you, or loosely set for you. I chose to write on a filmmaker who I'm very interested in and love, Rainer Werner Fassbinder. And I gave a version of this talk, a very, 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 very reduced version of this talk, a 10-minute version, that back in just before in O-Week, which was still when it was a bit of more of a working project, but I'm pretty happy with it, where it's at. And I'm going to talk to you about it today. So I will get started. So in the first 3 minutes of Rainer Werner Fassbinder's 1982 film, Veronica Voss, we see two figures sitting in a movie theater. In the center of the frame and in the foreground is the titular Veronica Voss, played by Roselle Zech. She stares intently at the projection of one of her early performances. In this sequence, Zech's performance of expressivity imbues Voss with a kind of manic intensity, an intensity that more than supports the suggestion the audience need pay attention to her character and her arc. It establishes her as a mesmerizing focal point for the rest of the film. Despite this, in this particular scene, spectatorial attention is stolen from Voss by the figure behind her, a filmgoer who appears interested in the film but seems mostly unmoved by it. He's fixed. The actor is none other than Fassbinder himself, the director, producer, and writer of the film, whose name has been forced on the audiences in Art Deco typography as part of the Hollywood noir-style overture which opens the film. Fassbinder has spent the opening credits ensuring that no one is mistaken about the architect, the genius, the mind behind the film. Now he sits still, unfazed, in the cinema. In this sequence, which seems, for all intents and purposes, designed to draw the audience's attention towards the exaggerated and expressionistic performance of Zech as Voss, Fassbinder diverts our gaze. He asks us to put his face to his name. In a strange moment that is at once both modest and dictatorial, Fassbinder joins us as an audience member while ensuring we also watch him. If not for the rich shadows and the two harsh lights that illuminate Fassbinder and Voss, his presence would be insignificant. He could simply be an extra. But instead, Fassbinder asserts himself using lighting and demands screen real estate. He occupies a space in the frame that undermines the effort of Zech to perform the magnetism of Voss. Fassbinder, in this metatextual moment, has demanded the audience know him as one of them, but also asserts himself as the undeniable figure who is the author and momentary subject of this film. For Fassbinder, his name is not enough. He must be an aesthetic device in his own films. Fassbinder was a prolific West German filmmaker who died at 36 in 1982, so that makes it pretty hard for him to be Michael Fassbender, which is a pretty common mistake. There's a story that apparently Fassbinder pretended for a while when he was first coming up in the industry to be Fassbinder's relative, but they are no relation whatsoever. So he made films, Fassbinder, made films that combine elements of urban realism with the excess of melodrama. He also appeared in many of his own films, this is my point, and he stands out as a radical queer filmmaker who used his own experience in the gay and bisexual communities in Germany to inform many of the political and moral themes that drive his films. So in this paper, I consider the ways in which Fassbinder's appearances in his own films performs an aesthetic, political, and authorial function. A filmic identity and style is devised, and the very notion of what it means to be an auteur or an author or a filmmaker is troubled and challenged. To organize this investigation, I describe three dimensions of Fassbinder's appearances. I call these insertion, assertion, and direction. Each of these expresses Fassbinder's use of camera, performance, and a myriad of other filmic choices to impose himself on the frame and to, once inside the film, control, manipulate, and refocus it. These dimensions can be found or are developed in the films Fox and His Friends, Ali Fear Eats the Soul, and Veronica Voss. I argue that Fassbinder appears in his own films to ensure a deeper creative control, one that gets inside the story and speaks through his own character. Fassbinder does not simply make a cameo appearance in his films like Hitchcock or Tarantino. Instead, he extends his role as director. To incorporate the responsibilities of author and performer. His skill in all three of these capacities allows him to embody a character, but also meticulously design and frame shots and direct and control viewers' attention, all from within a film. Using my aesthetic analysis of Fassbinder's appearances, I consider him against historical notions of authorship and auteur theory and in Europe and Hollywood. Further, Fassbinder must be read against the specific contextual and cultural dimensions of the auteur in the new German cinema. Finally, I consider Fassbinder's appearances as a form of political activism, and the extent to which his inclusion in his own films allows him to perform protest and discourse with nuance. The aesthetics of Fassbinder's appearances can be organized into three dimensions that I'm terming insertion, assertion, and direction. Insertion refers to the specific interrupted moment in which Fassbinder enters the diegesis, that's the world of the film, and in so doing begins to starve other characters of attention. Assertion is following this act of insertion, the total restructuring of meaning and even hierarchies of power within a given scene or frame. Finally, direction refers to the application of Fassbinder's authorial vision from within the film. This term, as it sounds, is a visible and extra-diegetic culmination of Fassbinder's appearance. He directs the audience and the film from within the frame. In each of these dimensions, Fassbinder uses every resource at his disposal to disrupt expectations and to dominate from within a film. The effect is to extend his control of the moral and political reception of his work. So firstly, insertion. The circumstances and tonality of Fassbinder's appearances in his films are different. He appears with visual subtlety in the beginning of Veronica Voss, which is a clip I saw you show you before, and with explosive animosity in a film like Ali Fear It's the Soul. Yet these appearances, however performed, are always interruptive and jarring moments of insertion, setting up the possibility of assertion and direction that will follow. In Fear It's the Soul, the protagonists are Emmy, played by Brigitte Mira, an older white German woman, and her partner Ali, played by Elhedi Ben Salem, a young Moroccan immigrant. Their relationship is the source of controversy, but in post-war Germany, the expression of distaste and hate is muted and complex. The taboo of Ali and Emmy's relationship is depicted by visually coding environments in a way that reinforces the culture of discrimination that hangs over their partnership. When the couple just married visits a restaurant described as a once regular haunt for Adolf Hitler, Fassbinder expresses their social imbalance by framing them as tiny and subordinated to the space. So that's them in the center there. Despite this, he places them in the center of the frame to illustrate their defiant protest, or perhaps their giddy naivety. Tableaus such as these of quiet inequality counterposed against unknowing resistance are littered throughout the film. It is only the insertion of Fassbinder into the visual logic of the film that exposes the violence and hate that truly fuels these more discrete examples of oppression. Indeed, Fassbinder, the filmmaker, frames the couple as small and isolated, but stable in their domestic environment. Fassbinder, the performer, appears as Eugen, Emmy's son-in-law, to perform extreme instability, racism, and ageism. From the moment he appears on screen, his aggressive presence interrupts the false comfort and sense of security established in earlier scenes. To illustrate this, I consider a sequence in which Emmy visits her daughter Krista's apartment to announce that she's recently entered into a relationship with Ali. Fassbinder takes us to the apartment before Emmy's arrival to introduce us to his own character, a disgusting and profound bigot. We're just about there in a second. So this is just some of the examples of the other ways that Fassbinder frames Brigitte Mira and Betty Salim. So Fassbinder's insertion of himself, not only as a family member, but as a nasty and punitive husband, functions as a radical shift in the film, exposing the realpolitik of racism and sexism. He barks orders at his wife and mouths off about foreign workers at his construction job, calling them swine. But crucially, he also frames himself differently. Throughout this scene, Fassbinder has collaborated with his cinematographer Jürgen Jürges to compose and stage wide theatrical shots. Each of these linger on Fassbinder and actually rotate and pivot around him as though he is an axis on which narrative tension and politics can turn. While Eugen's dialogue is upsetting, for Emmy, it does not bear the same weight and emotional impact as the response of her daughter Krista. Reaction shots of Emmy show us that Krista's laughter is what leaves her stunned. Yet in a sequence that conventionally would align the audience with the protagonist's emotional response, Fassbinder's aggressive insertion and the disruption it causes ensures that the audience cannot simply ignore him, as Emmy does. Indeed, Fassbinder's directorial vision and authorial presence anchors him as the visual focus of the scene. By inserting himself in such a harsh and interruptive way, Fassbinder introduces the audience to a version of himself that can appear within the frame as performer, but also maintain his power and privilege as director. That Fassbinder's visual interruption and insertion serves not only to alter the narrative content and trajectory of the film, but also its visual logic and patterns is evidence that his appearances in this film and others fulfill a directorial obligation as much as they do a performative one. By separating himself into performer and filmmaker, Fassbinder has attempted to make it possible to both become a vehicle for an excessive and exaggerated version of the prejudices that I've described, but also to maintain his integrity as a filmmaker who operates above the politics of the scene. I just want to add, though, it is, however, important to consider the moral implications of inhabiting characters such as these. Though Fassbinder's openly left politics are diametrically opposed to a lot of the rhetoric his character infuriates the soul espouses, there's a moral burden and danger to occupying the identity as a privileged white person. So Fassbinder's performance of racism should not be treated as objectively removed from his own privilege and politics. So next I'm going to tackle assertion. Having inserted himself into a given film, Fassbinder will then, for at least as long as he appears on screen, become the focal point of that film. This is what I'm terming assertion. And I now like to return to the sequence I showed you earlier from Veronica Voss. It could be argued that Fassbinder's appearance in this sequence is little more than a cameo. Certainly he doesn't have much screen time in these appearances, and nowhere near as much as Ali Fear It's the Soul, nor Fox and His Friends, which I'll turn to later. For that matter, his character isn't even given a name in this sequence or in the credits. Despite this, I'll argue that Fassbinder's appearance in this film is an example of assertion because it pits itself against a narrative convention and expectation that Zex Voss is the most important figure on screen. Veronica Voss, in many ways, presents a stylistic departure from some of Fassbinder's other work. In this film, in his attempts to convey much of the aesthetic and stylistic treatment of common to Hollywood film noir and cultural movements like Art Deco, Fassbinder must transform his own traditions and conventions to cohere with this different look. Fassbinder maintains his obscuring camera angles and his harsh use of light, further in continuing his working relationship with his cinematographer of over 10 years, Xaver Schwarzenberger. He manages to apply signature perspectival camera work that conveys power dynamics and class difference through staging, framing, and composition. However, the use of black and white and the extent to which the film is a period costume drama and its overt references and homages to American filmmakers reconfigures any audience's visual recognition of Fassbinder's particular style. So just to explain that a little bit further, if you were someone who'd seen a lot of Fassbinder's films, this film looks quite different. And it's deliberate. He's attempting to respond to some of the broader Hollywood traditions in other films, and one of the big ones in Veronica Voss is Sunset Boulevard. Thus, by inserting himself into the frame in this opening sequence, and further, by demonstrating the unending relevance and power, even against a performer as full of affect as Zesch, Fassbinder asserts himself and his control over the film and the scene. This obsessive maintenance of his image and desire to suture himself to that image resonates with the thematic and moral content of the film. The figures of Fassbinder and Voss serve to foreground themes of imagistic control and narrative redefinition that are ideological pillars of the film. There's also an extremely self-reflexive presentation of the psychological dangers of obsessing over one's own identity. Veronica Voss is a tragic figure whose fame and celebrity has disintegrated over time. Her fall from grace is facilitated by her participation in Nazi propaganda films. The film, as in this one, set in 1950s post-war Germany, sees her scramble to restore her favour with the public. Fassbinder, who died only a few months after this film's release, offers in this tale, and indeed throughout the film, a powerful investigation into the impossibility of self-eulogization. And finally, direction. I'm going to try and slow down a bit. In the act of inserting and asserting himself within his own films, Fassbinder interrupts patterns he has established and restructures hierarchies of power. He draws attention to himself in any given sequence or frame, and once he's successfully inserted and asserted himself, he becomes able to direct and control from within the film. To illustrate this point and to demonstrate its relationship to the earlier dimensions of insertion and assertion, I'll turn to the opening sequence of Fox and His Friends. So Fassbinder crafts this title sequence with a few visual and oral puns. These puns, as I am calling them, are playful nods to some of the responsibilities of the director via other technicians and roles. The puns build towards the moment in which the director himself is revealed as the film's protagonist, the character Fox. For example, The credit for music supervisor Peter Larvin is superimposed onto a frame of police sitting in a vehicle with closed windows that muffle the volume of the diegetic audio. I always hoped that I would read this and it would just perfectly line up, but I guess it never was going to happen. but you're not going to hear it anyway because I haven't got any sound in here, but it'll be just be there in a second. I'll just wait for it. It's pretty interesting to me anyway. So it's just after this year. So the music, which is the sort of sounds and ambient noise of the circus, obviously directed by Peter Rabin and Larvin, it's muffled in this moment. And you don't hear it at all in the same way. Anyway, the credits for assistant director and camera assistant become the recapitulation of the relationship between leader and assistant. This is another example of a pun. They are rendered almost ineligible as they are overlaid on panning shots of faces in a crowd at the circus. This shot is a reaction or response to the call of the ringleader. Fassbinder's obscuring of the names becomes symbolic representation of the hectic and chaotic relationship between director and assistant. These puns are not designed to mock or devalue members of Fassbinder's crew. Instead, they introduce the audience to the notion of creative control, which is the bedrock of Fassbinder's authorial presence. Despite the value of these roles and their importance, Fassbinder remains the supreme influence over the film. He appears on screen as a painted image of himself, a pale and bemused head pasted on the front of a large circus tent. He is in fact presenting himself as the role of the performer, the severed head. In this moment, he crystallizes his supreme influence by introducing his appearance in the film as a decapitated head, a literalization of the term mastermind, or in German, the Der Führer der Kopf. Fox and His Friends offers a fitting conclusion to my analysis of insertion, assertion, and direction. Fassbinder inserts and asserts himself into the role of protagonist in this film. He already has the audience's attention, simply earned by being the protagonist. However, in this opening sequence and throughout the film, as well as throughout his appearances in Fear Eats the Soul and Veronica Voss, Fassbinder manages to direct and organize audience attention. He positions himself such that politics and morality are determined by his physical relationship to objects and people in the frame. Okay. So the school of thought that developed out of the French New Wave introduced the concept of the auteur. The term almost needs no definition, as the intersection of popular culture and academia formed by the French New Wave's contribution to French film journal Cahiers du Cinéma has made the word ubiquitous and virtually inseparable from conceptions of filmmaking. It's probably safe to say that even if you're not a film student in this room, you've probably heard the term auteur. In short, however, the term describes a sole creator or author figure to whom the quality and product of a film can be attributed. Crucially, the object of auteur theory is to recognize the cultural and stylistic signature of a certain director's body of work. The exact parameters of the term, and indeed its explicit limitations, were the source of heated debate amongst the likes of André Bazin, François Truffaut, and Jean-Luc Godard. Bazin would find himself unable to agree with his colleagues about the stylistic continuity of their beloved auteurs, explaining that a system that praised the universality of an authorial aesthetic and quality was itself an exercise in curation. The ethical nature of this curation is then brought into relief, with Bazin querying the ways in which the appraisal of a given filmmaker would omit certain films, only to later read them through the rose-tinted lens of that same appraisal. In his piece, La Politique des Auteurs, Bazin writes, "Many a time I have felt uneasy at the subtlety of an argument which completely failed to camouflage the naivety of an assumption whereby, for example, the intentions and the coherence of a deliberate and well-thought-out film are read into some little B-feature." This form of critical analysis is, as Bazin notes, imbalanced. The strategy of auteuring requires rigidly evaluating a filmmaker as possessing specific qualities and making specific choices. Among the many criticisms of auteur theory, here we encounter the problem of its lack of dynamism. Filmmakers are inconsistent and ever-changing, and so attempting to assert distinct and strict attributes is a losing battle. In some way, auteur theory combats this problem by establishing itself as a critical strategy that is applied retrospectively. A tenet of auteur theory that is sustained across debates about its meaning is that it is an identity earned rather than cultivated. That is to say, Jean Renoir or Alfred Hitchcock did not actively attempt to become auteurs. Instead, their status as auteurs was determined by a judgment made about them via the critical work of others. This process of auteuring filmmakers after the release of their film becomes an artistic and industrial pillar of European cinema in the 1950s. From the three dimensions of analysis I presented above, previously, because this is not written word, it is evident that Fassbinder is not prepared to wait to be deemed an auteur. Instead, his appearances are deliberate attempts to declare his identity as a filmmaker in the moment of reception, so as we're watching him. Fassbinder's liveness and his constant cultivation of an on-screen identity interrupts the slow, cumulative approach of auteur theory. The temporality and context of Fassbinder's appearances is also a result of New German cinema's specific economic and industrial frameworks that I'll discuss a little bit now. So Fassbinder's work has been recognized for its valuable contribution to the entire film canon, but his body of work and his celebrity is in many ways indebted to the systems and industry of New German cinema that were established under the influence of a body called the Filmverlag der Autoren. Film scholar Thomas Elsesser writes on this. He says, Filmverlag der Autoren determined the political and administrative machinery put in place to fund films practically, and it furnished the criteria which validated filmmaking as art. By being accepted as an author, a filmmaker found access to the subsidy system and could command a certain legal and financial power within it. Fassbinder was a member of the Filmverlag der Autoren, and I'll just explain it a little bit more. So the Autoren was a group of filmmakers from West Germany with significant political power. They affected the creation of an industrial and economic recognition of a film as a form of art. So normally when film gets brought into the world of industry and entertainment, or normally in other cultures, it has been, become a kind of commodity that doesn't necessarily maintain its capacity to be described as art. But as a member of that group, Fassbinder gained access to the financial resources and political resources to become a cultural authority and for his identity as a filmmaker and author to exist beyond these films. Fassbinder's public identity and celebrity fashioned through this system allowed him to claim instant legitimacy and authority for himself as a filmmaker, even before his work had been widely distributed. Further, he was able to interweave that same identity into his body of work so that it arrived in front of the audience already imbued with cultural capital. Sheila Johnston puts it like this. She says, Autoren were defined as authors from the very outset, often before they had even made a film. Imagine being a filmmaker before you made a film. It's a good spot to be in. Fassbinder's celebrity becomes a financial and legal determinant of his own capacity to make films. His name and image have institutional, economic, and cultural capital. His choice to place himself prominently within his own films is thus an artistic, economic, strategic, and political form of identity. So next I'm just going to briefly touch on USA auteurs because that has complicated implications here. The migration of auteur theory to the United States also has a bearing on the way Fassbinder is represented on and off screen. Hollywood was introduced to auteur theory by academic Andrew Saras. Saras, much like all of those involved in the creation and use of the term, would come to defend it and argue for its value in response to constant journalistic and academic scrutiny about auteur theory's validity. Okay, so this is a long quote. In his piece, Notes on Auteur Theory, Saras writes, the way a film looks and moves should have some relationship to the way a director thinks and feels. This is an area where American directors are generally superior to foreign directors because so much of the American cinema is commissioned. A director is forced to express his personality through the visual treatment of material rather than through literary content of the material. Joseph L. Mankiewicz and Billy Wilder are other examples of writer-directors who, without adequate technical mastery. By contrast, Douglas Sirk and Otto Preminger have moved up the scale. I have to stop because, I mean, obviously saying that American films are superior is a problem in and of itself, but also Douglas Sirk is a German immigrant to the US, so the logic there makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Yeah, and Preminger, exactly, yeah. So really, it's a very odd comment for him to make, especially also because he took the theory from France. But anyway, whatever. Okay, so I'll keep going. So Saras' comments on the visuality of American film culture are a compelling, albeit a little bit tangential way to connect auteur theory back to Fassbinder. I'm speeding up. In the American context, prior to auteur theory's cultural dominance, whereby a successful film was associated with its successful director, the star system was used to provide industrial and stylistic continuities for audiences. For example, Clark Gable and Joan Crawford would have been celebrated and advertised as part of the film Dancing Lady rather than the film's director, Robert Z. Lennon. So you can see, I'm pretty sure I've looked at this several times, Robert Leonard's name is not on this poster, which is a world away from what you get now. I mean, if you look at something like Ready Player One, that's basically just Steven Spielberg's name and nothing else. So it's the part of the logic and the way we understand and advertise the films has completely changed. Fassbinder's identity as an authorial figure learns a great deal from figures like Douglas Sirk, who Saras mentioned, whose status as a German auteur in America is celebrated through Fassbinder's film Ali Feeds the Soul. However, I argue that Fassbinder's authorial identity is also developed in line with the celebration of figures like Clark Gable and Joan Crawford. For Fassbinder is not sufficiently able to be represented by a byline, a brief cameo appearance, or as the famous example with Alfred Hitchcock, even a silhouette. Instead, Fassbinder must inhabit the frame to culturally and cultivate a visually recognizable identity that is always associated with the notion of creator, author, and director. There he is there. But is simultaneously a conduit for difficult and confronting performances, which in many ways is just a way of describing how naked he is in this film. I'll keep going. So where auteur theory asks critics and scholars to divine a director's unique traits by examining and evaluating their body of work, Fassbinder presents a counterpoint to the authorial identity that is contemporary and live. His vicious and unflinching character portrayal signals his style, his versatility, and his meaning. He's not an invisible hand, but he's an overly visible presence, constantly defining and performing himself in his filmmaking. In her book, Performing Authorship, Cecilia Sayer discusses the inability of famous filmmakers like Woody Allen and Jean-Luc Godard to perform characters that are truly divorced from their real-world identities. She argues that the consistency of their performances and the cultural and stylistic continuities of the characters they inhabit and create presents them as an exaggerated on-screen version of their celebrity selves. You might think Woody Allen would want to be really distant from himself, but whatever. She writes, the filmmaker's presence on the screen then acts as an element of disruption, both on the level of plot and on the level of the viewer's engagement with the individual works. For the author's presence draws attention to the process and establishes the film as artifice. Her argument illuminates a kind of relationship between director and performance, one that can be easily dismissed as an overflow of ego. Here, filmmakers like Godard and Allen cannot help but be themselves. I argue that this exposure of artifice is not explicitly intentional. Sayer does not draw conclusions to this end, though. She argues that Allen and Godard are conscious of their interruption to an assumption of suspended disbelief. But perhaps her analysis can be applied more literally and usefully to filmmakers like the self-reflexive Abbas Kiarostami, who appears in his own films Close Up and Taste of Cherry, or inventive and experimental filmmaker Alejandro Jodorowsky, who appears in his own film Holy Mountain. These films deliberately and jarringly reveal their artifice to the audience that's watching them. By exposing the mechanics of filmmaking and by literally showing camera equipment and the directors that operate them. Fassbinder's performances of authorship within his films, it's a stark contrast to all of those filmmakers I've just described. His films actively encourage distrust of on-screen events, and his style reinforces the artifice of film. But his appearances are so perfectly interwoven into the authorial and directorial vision that he himself becomes a part of the aesthetic of his own films. Instead of simply appearing and reminding the audience that the film that has captured their attention is fantasy or even subterfuge, Fassbinder's appearances serve to generate and direct distinctive social, political, and aesthetic traits. The three dimensions of insertion, assertion, and direction allow Fassbinder to use his performative identity to control and position the moral and political content of his films. The image of a celebrity like Hitchcock in his own films resembles a watermark, a declaration of ownership. These watermark cameos are indelible, but they don't corrupt the image to which they're applied. The same simply cannot be said of Fassbinder's interference in his own films. Fassbinder enters his films to break their visual logics and to demonstrate intense political identity. His performance of racism in Ali Fear It's the Soul is an example of this. As a performer, director, and author, Fassbinder harnesses his unique ability to direct and transmogrify the content of his films, and further, the mechanisms and strategies audiences can use to engage with his films. So Fassbinder's films are openly and explicitly political. Across his prolific career, he continually interrogates oppressive and dangerous ideologies like capitalism, racism, and homophobia. This interrogation is only complicated and enhanced by his decision to perform in his own films. I argue that this choice intersects with Fassbinder's broader project of live and current authorship, as I've discussed. His identity, which is continually reworked, defined, and presented on screen, becomes itself a visual space or domain for radical and intense political discourse. Fassbinder's performance as the titular character in Fox and His Friends exemplifies this. After the title sequence I've described, police rush the stage and arrest the circus ringleader. Fassbinder's severed head character, now revealed to be a mere man, appears wearing cadaverous makeup from the head up and jumping out from behind the curtain. Now exposed as a performer rather than a real severed head, Fox sprints across the stage to defend his lover, the ringleader. Fassbinder's camera then lingers on a shot of a kiss between the ringleader a kiss which is immediately representative of the competing oppressions and controversies that play out in the film. In this moment of tension and drama, Fassbinder has used his own body as and the backdrop of a circus tent to transform this film into a politically charged reflective surface. Here he performs a melodramatic spectacle of queerness that is interrupted by police and cheered on by a crowd. The stage is a venue for performance within the film, but also without it. It tightly directs and controls the way a cinema-going audience that watches this film perceives of the passionate embrace. In his book, Fassbinder's Germany, Elsässer argues that Fox and his friends, Fassbinder... Oh, hang on, I'm going to stop myself. This has no bearing on anything I've talked about. Well, I guess it does, but I just love this because these are one of a few sequences in the film where Fassbinder does this amazing thing where he frames himself so that he doesn't get any glare on himself in the windscreen. But it's just one of a million different examples of how he can totally design and compose shots that draw attention to himself from within the frame. It's pretty cool. Anyway, in his book, Fassbinder's Germany, Elsässer argues that that in Fox and his friends, Fassbinder responds to a politically correct perspective from without. He writes, "The perspective from without sees an abstract schematicism or a devastatingly total pessimism, which was felt to be reactionary at a time and in a situation, 1974, when homosexuals were fighting for a fairer and more positive representation in the media." Elsässer argues that this corrective attitude is a radical politics against which Fassbinder rails. I would, however, contend that the politics presented by Fassbinder in Fox and His Friends are actually more representative of a contemporary and radical queer identity politics. Fassbinder offers a realistic and nuanced portrayal of queer identity. In Fox and His Friends, his characters Fox's intersecting struggles of class and sexuality resist caricature, even of a positive kind. Instead, Fassbinder depicts queer identity with the same integrity that would be applied to heterosexual characters. The specific reference that Elsässer is making is to some of the criticism Fassbinder received for his depiction of queerness in the film. Fassbinder's choice to present characters who are messy, vindictive, complex, was a source of much controversy. And in an interview with Norbert Sparrow, Fassbinder addresses this. Sparrow says, "In the final analysis, the film is about the class struggle that happens to take place in a gay milieu. But homosexuality per se was never posed as a problem." And Fassbinder says, "That's the film I've made, but they didn't see this film. They only saw homosexuals making mistakes. They wanted to be exhibited as a good, kind, and friendly people. And that would have been a lie. I'd have been saying they didn't have any problems. If everything's great, fine, you've got nothing to change." As Fox, Fassbinder is able to create a visual and cultural identity that becomes representative of his own queer experience. To argue that the community of which he was a part has problems, Fassbinder becomes an on-screen representative of that community. There is, as such, a political and aesthetic device at play that allows Fassbinder to not just apply scrutiny to queerness on screen, but to actually invite that scrutiny. His performance becomes a form of on-screen protest that gives as much credibility to his character's sexuality as would be given to a heterosexual character in any other film. Fassbinder's decision to perform as Fox gives the character legitimacy. His own experiences in the bisexual and gay communities in West Germany are used to inform the character and his interactions. From being introduced to filmgoers as a mysterious severed head, only to be later revealed as a struggling gay man, Fassbinder constructs a powerful metaphor for his authorial experience. He uses his privilege and power as a director in conjunction with his reality and sensitivity as a performer to advance a nuanced political position. He is at once a disembodied figure who has complete control and a performer who is vulnerable to prejudice. Fassbinder, by appearing on screen in this film and others, is redefining what it is to be a director, author, and performer. I've shown that Fassbinder's appearances can be organized into three dimensions: insertion, assertion, and direction. These are each used by Fassbinder to blur the lines of filmmaker, author, director, and performer. From within his films, Fassbinder is able to enact a creative control that allows him to advance a political, moral, and social critique with nuance. My hope is that these dimensions might be usefully gleaned from other filmmakers' work and to allow control, creation, and performance to infringe upon each other's boundaries more freely. Thank you. All right, here we go. Thank you.
Okay, so this kind of section of the evening is going to be a sort of Q&A session. So we're going to first kick off with... Dr. Michelle Langford, who's a film scholar here at UNSW. Her sort of area of expertise is principally in Persian cinema and, more relevantly, German cinema. And she's also Zach's honours supervisor. So Michelle's going to sort of do a bit of a response and ask some questions specifically to Zach, and then she'll open it up to the floor and you guys can ask any questions you have. Sort of go from there.
Great. Well, I won't dominate the time too much, but I wanted to say first, congratulations, Zach, on bringing this little research project to. Well, it was a big research project for you.
Yes.
Coming straight out of your undergrad, and it was really kind of the longest thing that you'd ever written. So congratulations, and I think I want to kind of just highlight watching for me what the pleasure was. In watching the way that you kind of really developed this beautiful kind of theoretical framework for thinking about the different ways that Fassbinder manifests his presence on screen, and for kind of articulating that through a series of really clear examples. And as I've been reading your work over the last couple of months and listening to you talk about it and give your own examples, there are other examples from some of his other films that keep resonating in my mind. The one that is probably closest to my heart, and what's kind of interesting about this, is my own honours experience was deeply involved with Fassbinder, because I wrote about Fassbinder's The Marriage of Maria Brown and also the work of Alexander Kluge. So we're kind of coming full circle here. But there's a wonderful moment in Fassbinder's The Marriage of Maria Brown where Fassbinder suddenly appears, and he functions very much in the ways, and I'm trying to kind of figure out whether it's an act of insertion, assertion, or direction, and I think it's a combination of all of them. So what he does is the central character is Maria Brown. It's set in the immediate post-war Germany, and she's a woman whose husband has gone missing in the war, and she doesn't know if he's alive or dead. And she has to do whatever it takes to just live, okay? So what she does is she decides that she has to sell her body in order to survive. And in order to do that, she needs a nice dress. So she takes some things from the household, and she turns up in this kind of like, you know, bombed out place, and Fassbinder appears. And he has this kind of little sort of cardboard suitcase, which he opens up, and he's got all these different things. And he's basically the center of the black market. And it's him that basically exchanges some things that she has brought for a little black dress. And what girl doesn't need a little black dress? And through that, it's through that exchange and through his act as this kind of black marketeer, which I think is very much like an act of direction. And it's through this that facilitates the development of Maria Brown's narrative. And where it becomes political is that Maria Brown in the film functions as a kind of an allegory for the German economic miracle. And it's only through that process of bartering, exchange on the black market, so, you know, unsavoury business practices, let's call it, that are directed by the director himself, that her miracle rise to relative fortune is achieved. And so what you've given me is a completely different way of thinking about his appearance in that moment. So thank you for that. That was really nice. I wanted to build on this idea of the kind of political dimensions of his appearances. And I wondered if you would be willing to kind of say a little bit more about these kind of really controversial figures that he plays. So the racist in Ali Fear It's the Soul, and the way in which he creates his character as this kind of problematically queer figure in Fox, and whether you might be able to expand a little bit more on the political dimensions of those appearances.
Yeah, I think it's tricky. I mean, I think I was speaking to someone recently about this who was a little bit dismissive of my argument and said that basically Fassbinder just wants to do what every actor wants to do, which is to play the villains, which are the best roles. But I think that that's a bit of a reductive
way of understanding him, because there's something to be said about taking the opportunity to become the conduit and sort of responsible person who has to deal with the most negative and difficult concepts. So to put that another way, rather than making anyone in his cast have to deal with these kind of more difficult portrayals, he takes that responsibility and burden upon himself. Like I said in my talk, I think a more contemporary analysis of politics of film would probably trouble the kind of indulgence of allowing yourself to play someone who is so horrifically racist, even if in supposed real life you don't hold those same beliefs. But I do think that particularly the character in Fox and His Friends, who is of course a struggling person, but is also pathetic. And I mean, really, throughout the premise of Fox and His Friends, I haven't explained this, is Fox, Fassbinder's character, essentially wins the lottery, and comes into fortune going from being very, very working class and struggling at this circus to suddenly having a lot of money. And is just endlessly taken advantage of by upper-class gay men. And it's excruciating to watch because it gets to the point where he really is making decisions that no person would make, and why he would put himself in this role where he's just so pathetic. You can't at all relate to his experience because you would just in his position say, no, I'm sorry, I'm being taken advantage of. I can't let that happen. But that performance of identity allows him to grapple really cleverly and in a nuanced way with those intersections of his class and his sexuality, because it allows him to become an identity that deals with all of the different dynamics that oppress him in different ways. So I think that him playing those characters is complicated and not straightforward and difficult to understand in many ways, but I also think it's not as simple as just wanting to play the villain. I think he's doing it to try and take some of the pressure off other cast members, and I think he's doing it because he thinks he can best identify with some of these experiences.
Mm-hmm. So he can sort of push those roles further, yes, than he could ask someone else to push
I think
them.
So, yes.
Yeah. I want to step back a little bit, and I think the question I always get asked, you know, how did you get interested in whatever I'm researching at the moment? And I think people might be interested to know, what was it that spurred you on to this research project?
So I saw Fassbinder's Ali Fear It's the Soul, which is the film that I talked probably the most about, I think, in that presentation. Well, no, I guess not. But anyway, I saw that film and I loved it in second year film studies here at UNSW in Jody Brooks' course, Contemporary Approaches to Film. I think
probably Emmy's doing it.
Yeah. No, well, I think there's a couple of people in the course.
Great.
But anyway, it's a great film. But I remember watching it and being a bit thrown by the way that Fassbinder loves to kind of really soak himself in the uncomfortable moments and the really difficult moments. And I remember watching the film, and there's this really sad, really upsetting moment when Ali, who is Ali, he, having decided that maybe the particular circumstances of the situation where he's in a relationship with Brigitte Mira's character, Emmy, an older white German woman, are just not tenable anymore, he decides he has to leave her. And in that moment, there's this extraordinary sequence where Fassbinder just stays a little bit back from a doorframe and watches as Emmy's character is crying and crying over being broken up with, essentially. And the landlord walks up past Emmy, says, "What are you doing?" And she says, just devastated, sort of ignores her and then walks on. And it was really weird to me because it's a profoundly upsetting moment, but the response of most people in the room was to laugh because it was so weird that this completely heartless landlord would just move on. I didn't laugh, which was not to say that I'm somehow better than anyone else, but what was interesting about it was that there was a social dynamic there, that Fassbinder was forcing the audience to grapple with this kind of really complex emotional problem that we laugh at as a kind of almost response to how antisocial that behavior is, to not look after this person, to not respond to their trauma. But it's also very real. And so I remember thinking, shit, like, this is a really different way of watching film and really different way of understanding film. And so I think at the time I was probably annoyed, like, I'm feeling sad, why are you all laughing? But now I think of it as this kind of like really profound moment where I reconcile with his ability to control and to deal in this realm of discomfort that is extraordinary. So that's why I like him.
Yeah. I think we often laugh at those kind of moments of discomfort. I mean, and it's a moment in which we get this kind of visual irony of the kind of the melodramatic emotion of Emmy contrasted with the complete sort of disinterestedness of the landlord. And I mean, as you know, I mean, Fassbinder was very much influenced by the work of Douglas Sirk. Yes, yeah. And my experience of having previously taught the work of Douglas Sirk to undergraduate students is that it becomes, you know, these kind of like heavily melodramatic films become these kind of like comic, it's a kind of ongoing series of laughter throughout the films, because the pitch of that melodrama, it doesn't resonate very well with contemporary audiences because it's too enhanced. And I think perhaps that's something that Fassbinder had very much picked up on.
I agree.
From Sirk. I'm going to now cast open the floor to questions. So please just let me know if you have a question for Zach. I'm sure we'll leave it. We'll give a little pause. And I'm sure there's a few questions bubbling away down there.
Why these particular Fassbinder films?
The very honest answer, or the answer, would be the very honest answer was just simply time, because Fassbinder, for someone who died after only being alive for 36 years, made this extraordinary number of films and television that it is very hard. And also because I seem to be one of few people interested in this particular topic, there's no Wikipedia page that lists all the films Fassbinder appeared in. So it's just simply hard. I would have to sift through them all. But also because I think these three films provide something interesting, which is to show that, particularly in comparing him to someone like Goddard or Allen or Hitchcock, who every time they appear, it's a version of the same thing. Fassbinder, every time he appears, is doing something really different, but is managing these continuities and this kind of aesthetic. So that was what was really interesting to me, is that in Veronica Voss, he's there for a couple moments at the beginning of the film. In Fox and His Friends, he's the protagonist. And in Ali Ferris, the Sully shows up in about three or four scenes as this racist. And all of those appearances are so different, but all kind of part of a broader aesthetic framework. So using each of those as a kind of point of comparison to each other to see the diversity and breadth of the way that he uses that particular strategy, that was really interesting to me. But also just, I couldn't watch that many. That was the other thing.
And you only had 5,000 words.
Yeah, exactly.
But actually, in relation to that opening sequence of Veronica Voss, you allowed me to watch it again a couple of times, right? Even just the way that he's kind of, like, Voss is kind of just there. She's just all face, right? And he's kind of doing this thing with his hand on his chin, and he's kind of, you know, he's actually doing something. I mean, it's not exaggerated, but he's kind of, it's an interesting sort of posture that he takes, and it's very odd that he just appears there.
Especially because he puts his name in the credits so many times before
before he comes on screen. And how slowly does his name float across the screen with the shadow behind it? Right?
But it's also a particularly weird moment, and the reason I kept getting drawn back to that sequence was because Veronica Voss in that Rosal Zech in that moment is playing this almost silent film character. Mm-hmm. Her face is doing these huge motions, and Fassbinder's sitting there. I mean, he's definitely doing something. He's definitely interacting in a way. But the comparison of the two, where Fassbinder represents a kind of maybe realist performance style, and Veronica Voss is this huge personality that is just desperately trying to grab your attention, and then here he is pulling it away. I mean, why do that, and why almost corrupt your own film? And if not for reasons of ego, then what is there that could be done with it?
And don't forget that the film that she's watching, it's not like some pre-existing film, but it's a film that mini film that he made.
Yeah.
So effectively, he's sitting there watching his own film as well.
Yeah,
so there's a kind of a self-reflexive element there too. Other questions? Yes.
Do you think because he reused a lot of his cast in many of his films, like he had kind of a cult following almost, that kind of culture together? Do you think that's part of his authorship, with all of the really close relationships he had with all of his cast? and how he reused them, even though he may have changed the style of his films?
I mean, it's certainly significant that he comes back to the same performers. And there's also, across things like the trilogy, so there's a trilogy of him, and the BRD, is it
the BRD trilogy
that he makes, which are films that are separate but have kind of continuities between them as well. There is a deliberate attempt to sort of attach some of those kind of faces and connections to certain meanings. So he definitely uses that same ensemble again and again because he has a kind of commitment to them and an interest in the performances that they provide. But I also just think it's the timing of it. I mean, he was making so many films so quickly that he had a cast that worked with him. And they also, I think
they
it's a theatrical...
So they actually, before he started making films, he was part of what was a theatrical group known as the Anti-Theater or the Anti-Theater. And many of the people that appeared in, particularly in his earliest films, were all members of the Anti-Theater. So, and some of them kind of continued on through the rest of their career with him. Yeah.
I have a half-baked question that you can finish baking. I just wondered, sort of a couple of things that have been emerging as we've been talking, and one of them is this idea that his appearance is a form of alienating, in a sense, or something almost Brechtian about it. It makes you very aware of the mechanics of it. Then, with the political kind of aspect of the film, that sort of aligns interestingly. But how does that kind of then relate to this idea of an auteur, where you kind of mentioned this idea of an ego and maybe putting like a mark on something in some ways? How would the sort of Brechtian political aspect and the auteur kind of work together, I wonder?
I mean, I don't think it should be... I would never want to be misconstrued as saying that Fassbinder doesn't have an enormous ego. He does. I think he's pretty... I think he thinks quite highly of himself. But I think that part of that distinction that I'm making, and I very, very quickly mentioned someone like Tarantino, and who has been described by people as an auteur, whether you agree with that or not. His appearances in films are so deliberately kind of this performance of a kind of a gag or an identity that is really just Tarantino wanted to be in the film. It was fun, and it's kind of part of his sort of love of cinema, that sort of thing. I think that that point that I keep coming back to, that Fassbinder is comfortable or chooses to play racist or very pathetic characters, is a complicated one because, yes, it still serves the benefit of him inflating his ego by being on screen, but it also is... it's someone that you either hate or feel completely unsympathetic to after a certain point because of the choices he makes. And so on that level, kind of controlling the film and being the author of this film, but also making you feel uncomfortable that this person that is so associated with the control that he has over the film but is also maybe not that great, that's a really uncomfortable tension and dynamic that I'm sure can be found in other filmmakers, but I can't think of too many examples or really any at this point. But yeah, I just think that particular thing that he does is, my feeling is that it's unique to him because of the way that it kind of pits exactly those two points of tension, the kind of ego and wonder of being the fantastic, omnipotent figure at the top of all of this, and then also this just bad guy that you don't want to connect to that much, or you find repulsive or sympathetic but in a pathetic way, or you know, so yeah.
I was just thinking that the way you described that comparison between the rather hateful fellow that you don't really want to have anything to do with, it also makes it all rather subliminal, because it's non-verbal, and so most of the time you're just looking at the pathos of the young people you need to feel compassion for, and you're sliding over the racist or the... I'm not so sure about the pathetic one, maybe that I haven't seen that film, but I have seen the one
Fear is the Soul.
Destroys the soul, eats the soul.
Yeah.
So it's all a little bit like when movies didn't have words. Mm-hmm. It was just all mime. Because there is very little verbal stuff in it.
Well, that's, I mean, I think the scene that you showed, it works completely without the sound. I mean, I think what you're picking up on is exactly Fassbinder's ability to communicate both through the kind of the gestural performance, but also through the selection of the shots that put him in the frame like that.
I think in terms of the subliminal as well, I mean, certainly it's hard in the context of a presentation to or talk to see the way that those scenes operate in the film, but Eugen's character, or the Fassbinder's character Eugen, only appears about three or four times in that film. Maybe not even, maybe just two, actually, really, I think. And one of the sequences is when a TV gets kicked in, which is pretty amazing to watch. But it is that weird thing that, especially because Fassbinder is a kind, is a filmmaker that really teaches you and establishes a visual fabric and language that, you know, like I was showing with those examples of Emmy and Ali, you know, really small in the frame or kind of disconnected from their environment but able to kind of live comfortably. It's only that when he enters in these brief moments or longer moments in Fox and His Friends, but brief moments for the most part, where he actually uses the staging and the composition of the shot and the framework to actually to disrupt and interrupt the way we understand even the logic that he's created in this film. And I, you know, I think it's a great service to the, also the, a great testimony to also the cinematography he uses. And they're pretty common amongst that. Xaver Schwarzenberger is in a lot of them, and Jürgen Jurgis as well. And obviously he has a really collaborative relationship with both of them, but I think it's also even the way he's conscious of how he operates in those shots and how he has to center himself or become this very aggressive presence or small presence that interrupts the way we've previously understood parts of the film, that it, without having to explicitly say that, without having to explicitly turn and say, "Oh, this movie's about to be different now," you know, it's great.
Any more questions?
I just want to add on to that. I guess it also relies, just continuing on what you were saying, it kind of relies on him having great trust in his cast as well, because if there's all those kind of non-verbal cues happening, and it sounds like he's a bit of a control freak as well. you would want to have that trust in your cast that particular something very specific is happening between you and the other person sitting opposite you, or between two. You know, it's all the physical performance, really, those sort of subtle cues.
I think it's very theatrical, which is his background.
And he was known for working really quickly, so we can assume that he didn't do a lot of takes of these scenes. So, again, you know, the trust, and he did a lot of rehearsals before they actually did the shoot, you know, that helped him be able to work so quickly. Yeah.
On that note, can I ask about the economics of this? I mean, you made a lot of films, a lot of TV, as you point out. How was this received in a popular sense? Like, where was he getting his money from? Who was backing him to make this kind of stuff?
You're probably going to have a more detailed answer than me, but my understanding is that the Film Verlag Der Auteur and the group that he's a part of helps in getting that funding for at least part of his career.
Help to get the funding.
Yeah.
Okay, so there were a number of different ways, and what's that? The material that Zach presented on the German notion of the auteur as opposed to the auteur. So the French auteur, as Zach explained, is a kind of a mark of dignity that is applied after a filmmaker's made a bunch of films and critics go, wow, you know, we can notice the authorial signatures, right? In the German system, in the post-war period, there are a bunch of young, in the 60s, a bunch of young filmmakers decided enough is enough. The German film industry is full of crap entertainment films dominated by pornography. We need to intervene and establish a kind of an art cinema, right? But the mechanisms for funding that art cinema wasn't in place. So they lobbied government to get access to film subsidies that already existed for commercial films. But part of the condition of that was that the director was automatically considered to be the equivalent of an author of a novel. Okay, so whether or not they were the author of the screenplay or not, they actually applied to the film funding bodies as the kind of the creative intelligence behind the work, so that the government could say, this is an artwork and we are funding this on the level of art. Now, that system didn't work terribly well, because then the commercial industry lobbied again and again, the pornography films were getting more funding, and it was all very complicated. But television stepped in. So there were a number of, there were two national and a number of regional television stations. And the constitution of West Germany after the war had written in it certain clauses about public broadcasting. And public broadcasting effectively had a commitment to, or they had to meet a commitment to provide content for a range of socially diverse communities. And they took the opportunity to invite these young filmmakers in to effectively make films funded by television, but films that were still considered to be cinema and would still get screened in cinemas. So at the end of the day, the majority of the funding that they were getting was actually coming from television. So this is kind of a very sort of snapshot kind of look at it. But there were other means. Once they'd made an initial film, they could apply for a rating, a worthy or particularly worthy rating, and that would then give them access to further subsidy that could be put into a future film project as well. So there were a range of different things, so mostly sort of government and television sources, very little private commercial funding.
And they still weren't huge budgets or anything?
No, they weren't huge budgets. Yeah. And often the director kind of worked, their labour was considered part of the co-production of the film. Right. So effectively, most of them kind of, they got a little bit of pocket money and they could sustain themselves during the production. So most of the directors basically lived from project to project.
And I think
they didn't make a lot of money out of it.
No. Yep. Fassbinder probably spent it all on cocaine as well.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. But I mean, Fassbinder was one of the few directors that were quite internationally successful. So he did get good distribution agreements internationally, where he would have got a little bit of revenue from the distribution of his films.
And also, just two things there. One is the other thing that I think is necessary to consider in all of this is that there is probably, in that sense, an economic motivation to being in his own films as well, that it's a cost that he doesn't have to pay and that he feels he's able to do it. So that's a reality that I should not ignore. And the other thing is that he, in terms of the film Verlag de Autoren, Fassbinder has his problems with that organisation.
Well, they had to pay to belong to them for a start.
And he also, but he also, in his later life, in his very short later life, he talks about how He hated the way that some of them had such an anti-Hollywood sentiment because he was appreciating directors like Sirk, who had come from a German background to Hollywood and had changed some of the ways Hollywood was understood. So it's interesting to look at the way that the mechanics of New German cinema supported in many ways his particular identity, but I also think there are specifics that are unique to him that allowed him to operate as he does as well. So yeah.
Any other questions? Shall we call it a night?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Zach. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @SSSnetwork, like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies, and visit us at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.